The Theater History Podcast is supported by HowlRound, a Knowledge Commons by and for the theater community. It's available on iTunes and HowlRound.com.
Hi, and welcome to the Theater History Podcast. I'm Mike Leager. John Marston doesn't get as much attention as his more famous contemporaries, who included Christopher Marlowe and William Shakespeare. Now, a new project, the Oxford Marston, is trying to change that. Today we're joined by Dr. Jose A. Perez-Diaz and Dr. Matthew Stegall. Jose's a research fellow in the School of English at the University of Leeds and is in charge of producing the old spelling text of Marston's works. Matthew's a professor of English at Sheffield Hallam University and the co-general editor of the project. Jose and Matthew, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Hannes.
Let's start by talking about Marston himself. Who was he and what do we know about his life?
Marston was born in Oxfordshire in 1576, and he was the son of a famous lawyer of the period who was a member of the Middle Temple, one of the Inns of Court in London, which is one of the places that will be absolutely crucial in what Marston did in his life and his career. He was educated at Oxford. He went to Brasenose College. We know that he was there around 1592, when he was about 16 or so. And he's described as John Marston, Warwickshire gentleman, so a gentleman from the county of Warwickshire. He graduated with his Bachelor of Arts in February 1594. But since 1592, so 2 years before, he had been a member of the Middle Temple, like his father. So there was the expectation that Marston was going to become a lawyer, very much like his dad. So he went down to London. The thing with the Middle Temple is that you've got a community of young men, many of which were supposedly training for the legal profession, many of whom were not actually intending to do that. So, it was a very highly educated group of young men, very much given to going to the theater, enjoying themselves, entering poetry contests, and things like that. So Marston, quite early on, started writing satirical verse. And the first two books that he published in 1598 and 1599 were two collections of satirical poetry. Well, the first one was The Metamorphosis of Pygmalion's Image and Certain Satires, bringing together a sequence of poems, sort of very much, in the Ovidian sort of erotic tradition, very much like Venus and Adonis by Shakespeare, for example. And then the second half of the book was, a collection of satirical poems. The second one was The Scourge of Villainy in 1599, and that got him into trouble with the ecclesiastical authorities, to the extent that the Bishop of London and the Archbishop of Canterbury actually condemned these books to be burnt. So they were, taken to the public hangman to be burnt publicly, and that's one of the reasons why we've got so few copies of these two volumes of verse. So that was it. There was a ban on satirical poetry. So he started working for the theatre and writing plays. And he had quite a short but quite illustrious career in the theatre. He started working with the Children of Paul's. It was a children's company based in the precinct of St. Paul's Cathedral. So mainly made up of the choristers of St. Paul's. He wrote a series of plays with them and then moved on to another professional or semi-professional, if you like, company of players, the Children of the Queen's Revels, or the Children of the Royal Chapel, or the Chapel Royal, who played at the Blackfriars Theatre, which would subsequently become the King's Men's second theatre. William Shakespeare's acting troupe started using that playhouse from 1608. So we can perhaps talk a little bit more about the plays a little later, but we know that around 1606, 1608, he abandoned the theatre and became a clergyman. He was ordained in the Church of England, and his career stopped. He basically spent the last 25 years of his life in pious obscurity, just dedicated to his congregation. And of course, trying to, as much as possible, trying to detach his name from those plays that he had collaborated in. So, for example, we know that when the last play that he started writing, whose title is The Insatiate Countess, and starts with the most memorable opening line in English Renaissance drama, which is, What Should We Do in This Countess's Dark Hole came out, when that came out in 1613, he lobbied to have his name removed from the title page. And he was quite, you know, efficient with in that respect. And subsequent editions of that play came out with the name of the two actors who completed the play, William Barkstead and Lewis Machin. And that happened again in 1633 when the first collection of plays, of his plays, was attempted. Six plays brought together by William Shears, a publisher, in 1633. He also lobbied to have his name removed from the title page. So he very definitely didn't want to be remembered for writing these rather controversial plays.
It sounds like Marston was no stranger to controversy. I also understand that he may have done a stint in prison.
That is a biographical problem, which we are looking into. It has been stated that, obviously there was the Eastwood Ho affair, and he was in hot water for that. But there's a second possible term in prison, which again, we're just not certain about biographically, not something that we might investigate.
Yeah. But yeah. Yeah, in 1605 with Eastwood Ho, he narrowly escaped prison. I mean, that was a play that he collaborated in with Ben Jonson and George Chapman. And both Jonson and Chapman ended up in prison basically because they mocked the Scots, which is never a good idea if your king happens to be from Edinburgh. So both of them were imprisoned. Marston apparently was out of town at the time or something. He was not imprisoned. But yeah, that ties in with the whole wars of the theatres that perhaps we can discuss as well.
Can you tell us about some of Marston's most significant plays?
One of the interesting things about Marston's playwriting is that it's absolutely contemporary with, in particular, William Shakespeare. We have been using the line that if Shakespeare is the Beatles, then Marston is the Kinks. So if you think about plays exactly the same time as Shakespeare, kind of in rivalry with Shakespeare plays, often in dialogue with them, then you get, and yet still worth watching in their own right. They've got this spiky alternative voice. So, for instance, The Malcontent is sort of a cousin of Measure for Measure. It's about a disguised duke who's been deposed. He's apparently left town. He's not left town. He's disguised himself under a new identity and is back watching what's going on. The new identity he's taken on is of a malcontent, a kind of serially discontented person who rails about the wickedness and stupidity and just general sinfulness he sees all around him. And that's kind of interesting because that's one of Marston's favourite personae himself. He trades on that in his satires. And so the malcontent of the malcontent, who appears to be just such a figure, then at the end throws off his mask to reveal that he's really the deposed virtuous duke and to seize back his throne. So there's this interesting play about, I mean, people see it as a cousin of Measure for Measure, but you might also hear notes of The Tempest in this disguised duke reasserting his throne, not through magic, but through basically lying and trickery. So, for instance, you go to The Malcontent, which is a still occasionally revived, very interesting play with obvious parallels in Shakespeare.
Then, for example, you've got a couple of very interesting plays in the what we call normally the Antonio plays, sort of diptych of plays formed by a kind of tragic comedy called Antonio and Melida. And the sequel of that, which is Antonio's Revenge. Antonio and Melida is a kind of sort of version of Romeo and Juliet, if you want, two enemy families from the republics of Venice and Genoa. And the heirs of those two dukedoms, if you like, the elder children of both houses, fall in love. And the Duke of Venice is very much opposed to that. And, you know, he's trying to get them both killed, basically, at one point. But it all ends up, you know, quite happily. The only thing is that the play doesn't finish there. And it's a great way of thinking about comedy, if you like, in that maybe at some point you will realize that, you know, things are not as happy as they seem. And Antonio's Revenge, which responds to a certain extent to Hamlet, is a very brutal revenge tragedy. And by the end of that tragedy, Melida is dead. She's been imprisoned, and she dies of grief, thinking that Antonio is dead. Antonio, weirdly enough, and unlike Hamlet, does not die at the end of the play, but he endures to grieve the loss of his love of Melida. So it's quite an unusual pairing of plays if you think about it. And then what T.S. Eliot always thought was Marston's best play is the last play that he completed, which is Sophonisba, possibly completed around 1608, is it? Seven-ish? That'll do. And it's a wonderful Roman tragedy about this Carthaginian princess, possibly a black woman or a black character from the north of Africa, who in the end, rather than falling into the hands of the Romans, she commits suicide by drinking poison. And it's a fantastic play, full of music and a very sort of elaborate and highly ritualized visual presentation. And Suzanne Gossett, for example, who is editing that play for our project for the Oxford Marston, has said that it's a shame that Marston didn't carry on with writing plays, because this play was almost signaling a new direction for Marston's work as a dramatist. So he was going somewhere else with this. That's, of course, almost the end of the story.
What was Marston's theatrical world like? What do we know about how his plays were performed?
One of the very inventive things about Marston is this very extensive engagement with music. He's got particular, Sophonisba has this sort of operatic quality. The stage directions go into great detail about this exotic set of instruments that are employed, this sort of continuo of sound underneath the words. And certainly elsewhere in the plays, obviously he's working with choristers at various points in his career. He's got a really sensitive sense of the palette of effects you can get from music. So it's a very sort of a very musical theatre he does. Yeah.
There are two pretty interesting phenomena related to Marston's career. One are the so-called children's companies, and another is an incident called the War of the Theatres. Can you tell us about those?
I mean, the children's companies were operating at the time, both in as I was saying, in St. Paul's Cathedral, in the precinct, a tiny playhouse. I mean, we know very little about that space, but it must have been very, very confined indeed. And that, I mean, they were basically semi-professionals in the sense that, you know, they were there to gain an education and to sing in the cathedral. So they were not, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, professional actors in the sense that, you know, that we would understand today. As for the Blackfriars troupe, the Children of the Queen's Revels, those were, you know, a little bit more professional in the way they worked. They had occupied the Blackfriars Theatre when James Burbage, who was the manager of the Lord Chamberlain's Men, so we're talking about Shakespeare's own company, had bought that building in the Blackfriars precinct. It was on an old monastic precinct that was, you know, sold off in the Reformation. And this had been, you know, the big room where, for example, with Catherine of Aragon had been put on trial. And he fitted that room as a theatre. But and the intention was always to use it in the winter months rather than using the globe, the open air globe, which, of course, was not usable, you know, any time from September or October. You just couldn't use the globe. So, you know, the idea was to move the business indoors. Now, the problem was that the neighbors in the Blackfriars were not happy about that. So, a lady called Elizabeth Russell lobbied very forcefully alongside the neighbors to have that, to prevent the opening of that theater with an adult company of actors. So with the Lord Chamberlain's Men. So it was sublet to this children of the Queen's Revels, who were also attached to the Chapel Royal. So, you know, in a way they also had that, you know, that singing component. And they were operating, you know, for many years in that theatre until, you know, in 1608 the King's Men took over. But maybe you can talk about a little bit about the War of the Theatres, given that you've written a whole book about
indeed,
it.
Yeah, I have to be, yeah. It's a really, yeah, the War of the Theatres is this still controversial episode. Basically, I think the big picture is that it's a theatre in which suddenly people are getting interested in authors. Up till then, maybe authors are seen kind of like, you know, we might think of writing people or maybe even scriptwriters. There aren't many Hollywood scriptwriters you can name, probably. What happens is that authors start to get a sort of celebrity status themselves, and there's clearly a lot of testosterone around. Johnson talks about having had many fights with Marston and took his gun off him at one point. They're obviously having severe disagreements in the taverns of London. And at some points at least, this boils over into representing one another satirically in your plays. So Johnson writes this very bitter play, Paratasta, which very clearly puts Marston on stage as this sort of idiotic, bombastic poet. Marston's friend Thomas Dekker comes back with a play in which Johnson is depicted as an even more idiotic poet, and with kind of obviously thinly disguised versions of himself and Marston as the good guys. Whether Marston himself actually took part in this in his own plays, as we have them, is much less clear. Marston is certainly repeatedly interested in the question of what it means to be a satirist, the ethics of being a satirist, what do you have to be a good satirist. He's interested in writing satirical drama because a couple of the characters say they're going to do it. In some ways, it's not doing Marston a favour to see his work purely in terms of this personal feud, we would argue. Because what happens is you end up having an argument about is this Johnson, is this not Johnson. There are certainly issues in the air around what it is to be an author, is a dramatic author a poet, and should they have the reverence that comes with poets. And that's really what you start to see sorted out in these plays, is the sense that maybe dramatists can be literary figures. A sense which ultimately maybe paves the way for the rise of Shakespeare to be a national poet.
Mm. Yeah. And one of the things that Johnson satirizes in Poetaster, as Matthew was mentioning, is Marston's diction. So his choice of words, his very inventive creation of neologisms, of new words that he just basically made up. So in that play, the poet Crispinus vomits words into a bucket. I've got a list in front of me. For example, oblatrant, furibund, fatuate, obstupefact. And that... Some of those are Marstonian coinages and some aren't. They're just, you know, they're just trying to poke fun at Marston. But of course, Marston's own neologisms include things such as glibbery, bespurtle, gargalize, gnarly, pustulant, paraphernalian. So he was incredibly inventive. And one of the things that I've been thinking about while working on Marston this last couple of years is the fact that Marston's heritage might have something to do in that inventiveness, in the fact that Marston's mother, I didn't mention this, Marston's mother was from Italian descent. Marston's grandfather had been a physician who came from Italy, from Tuscany, so around Florence. So in a very crude and very direct and very literal sense, we can say that Marston is the only English playwright or the era of the age whose first language or whose mother language was not English, it was Italian. So in many ways he has a very free kind of attitude to just making it up, to coining new language with a completely different bilingual background, basically.
What are you trying to do with this project, and what will be the final result?
One of the frustrating things about being interested in Marston, for as long as I've been interested in him, is that he's actually a decent edition. It's a bit unclear what the limits of the Marston canon are, what can be said to be Marston's work and what can't. Even for those plays that are by him, there aren't many decent scholarly editions. There are some that have really never been edited at all. We thought that we could collect together into one place the text that Marston's. We could go right back to the early quartos and actually check what the readings on each page are, because early printing being what it is, the same book, the same edition of a book, can actually have different words on the page of different copies because of press corrections. Nobody had done a lot of that primary work. We thought we wanted to go back, look at all that, put the poems and the plays and the occasional entertainments next to one another. Just build a foundation to get a better sense of what you were looking at in this body of very interesting, very entertaining work. So that's where it came from, really, is the thought that it would be good to have a modern, consistent edition of Marston. It's going to come out in four volumes from Oxford University Press in 2020, and we hope that it will spur something of a Marston revival. There are, as I say, some Marston plays, Malcontent, Eastwood Ho, have had revivals in the 21st century. We think there are many more that have the potential to amaze and delight their audiences. And we're hoping that this edition will really start anew, enable people to appreciate these things more.
We'll post a link to the Oxford Marston's website, where you can find out more about the project and watch complete performances of his plays. We'll also post links to copies of his plays that you can read online. Jose and Matthew, thanks again for helping us learn more about John Marston.
Pleasure.
If you'd like to continue today's conversation, please visit HowlRound.com and follow HowlRound and @TheaterHistory on Twitter and Facebook. You can also visit our website at theaterhistorypodcast.net, where you can find links to all of our episodes. If you've got questions or comments about the show, email us at theaterhistory@theaterhistorypodcast.net. A big thank you to the staff at HowlRound who make this show possible. Our music this week is The Dark Is My Delight, a song from John Marston's The Dutch Courtesan, and it's sung by Allison Adair. Thanks as well to Tip Kress, who designed our logo. And finally, thank you for listening.